Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, Recycling Trade Publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. He's also a portfolio manager and financial advisor in Edmonton. You can find him on Twitter at HMACBE, H-M-A-C-B-E. His website, MacbethMacLeodPartners.com. Welcome back to the show, Hilliard.
It's always a pleasure, Jim.
Hilliard, is Canada's real estate bubble about to burst, or is it bursting?
I think it's bursting. I was just looking at the numbers that came out a few days ago, and they showed us a mild drop in prices in most markets. But the thing is, those numbers are delayed because it's a three-month average, and the main index that we use, called Terranet National Bank, they don't take the numbers until the sale has been registered at land titles, and that's often 2 or 3 months later. So the actual more up-to-date numbers of people, realtors talking, and of course it's hard to tell because anecdotally you get mostly anecdotes, you don't get actual real data. But just reading between the lines, it looks like prices are coming off fairly quickly. And you know, generally the people that don't have to sell will just sit or they'll take their house off the market. So the real trigger will be when people are forced to sell, usually by the lender, by the bank or by the private private lender. They'll force a sale in order to try and salvage what they can from the loan that they've made. And that stage will be the trigger of a much sharper downfall in prices.
Also, during the COVID shutdown, we didn't have foreclosures. Are foreclosures now bringing cheaper houses onto the market?
They haven't yet. So far there haven't been very many foreclosures, but the reason there weren't any before, other than just the COVID restriction on you weren't able to get into court, because to foreclose you have to go to a court and show that you've got the right to foreclose. But even apart from that, even if we hadn't had COVID, with house values rising as quickly as they can, as they have been over the years, last few years, there wasn't any need to foreclose. You could usually, get out of the deal and pay the lender back without losing any money or much money. So the real serious foreclosures start when prices are dropping. The lender panics and forces the situation, and that hasn't really started in earnest yet, but it will within a fairly short period of time, weeks and months, not years.
Now, roughly how much did house prices go up during that panic buying during COVID? 40%?
Well, you see these numbers thrown around and that sort of thing, but the actual indexes, I haven't looked at it to be precise, but it wasn't in that kind of category, but it was a pretty substantial rise. You know, over 20 years, prices have risen an average of 7% per year, which is basically means your house has quadrupled in value over 20 years, since 2000, 2001. And in the last, that little burst we had from after COVID, it would have been more than 10% annually. So 20% over 2 years, something like that.
Could the Chinese real estate crisis spread here?
It surely could, and one of the things that's always puzzled me, and I'm sure people have noticed it, was especially in the Vancouver area, people would talk about people coming with cash, and they would pay all cash to buy the property. But then when I talked to some of the people who are really knowledgeable about that, they informed me that actually there is a loan, but it's just in China. It's not in Canada. So in China, you're able to get a really cheap loan against your property, and most middle class households in China owned at least two or three properties, and then they would mortgage over there and then take the money and bring it here. They weren't sure about the how to get a mortgage in Canada, and then maybe they didn't want to divulge all of their personal information, so they would bring the cash from China and buy here. But there's leverage in the system, and the leverage in the system in China is even greater than the leverage in Canada. So and the leverage in Canada is pretty substantial as well. So what's happening now is the buyers of properties who were promised an apartment haven't been able to take possession of their apartment because the developers have run out of money and they can't finish building them. So people are pretty upset. And so what they're doing is they're refusing to pay their mortgage payments. It's a really unusual situation in China where they have to start paying the mortgage even before the property is built. So they take out the full purchase price. You know, the prices over there are lower, but say $200,000 or something like that. They start paying the mortgage on a $200,000 loan. And then when they notice that the developer isn't building the property, they get pretty upset. So they've stopped. Some of them are refusing to pay their mortgage payments, which is very unusual in a country like China, where the citizens tend to be very very good at obeying the rules.
Yeah, they have to be pretty upset there. I've heard about riots there, but again, the Chinese media being government controlled, you don't hear about it. I've just heard it from friends who have family there.
Yeah, so the other thing that's going on sounds related, but it may not be related, is some of the banks, some of the smaller banks in China, and it's quite widespread, actually, kind of coincidentally, I guess, at the same time, have been unable to pay out when people want to withdraw money. So it's like an old-fashioned bank run like we used to have in North America years ago. And the banks are refusing to pay out the depositors their money. And so there's been protests and even riots over that, and some arrests. The Chinese authorities have arrested the protesters, of course. But that's a scandal that is pretty big. But there's the information on that is very suppressed, because one of the things that our authority, like China, the government is really afraid of is a widespread revolt in a country like China. So they control the information pretty carefully.
Interest rates in Canada and the U.S., are they going to continue to rise as the central banks say they want to fight inflation? But is the problem for them, the inflation numbers, again, they're a lagging indicator. So inflation may be well down while they're still raising rates. Is that the big danger? So you don't just cause an economic slowdown, you cause a crash.
Yeah, the central banks are renowned for being asleep at the switch, and then when they finally start to move, and of course now they're not asleep anymore, now they're actively, aggressively raising rates, they do it at the wrong time. The time to have raised, you know, I would say, in my opinion, the time was about 7 or 8 years ago, before the house prices really got, they were already in a bubble, but there was a chance to save it from becoming a major crash. But of course that ship has sailed now. But instead what they did was they waited and they kept the interest rates really low. And even as recently as a couple of years ago, the Bank of Canada governor was saying, oh, rates are going to stay low for a long, long time. So that allowed everybody to go out and get mortgages under 2% and get loaded up on debt. And now they're raising interest rates. And as you say, they may keep raising them longer than they should. But the problem is going to be worse than that, though. There's the other aspect of it, is that inflation will probably turn out to be quite sticky. And the reason for that is, and you don't see this referred to very often, I'm quite shocked, actually, that the shelter component, or the housing component, they call it shelter, which includes rented accommodation as well as home owner-occupied accommodation, has a bunch of components in it, which I've written about a couple times on my weekend note that I put out. And shelter is 32% of the overall CPI in Canada, similar in the U.S., and 40% of core CPI. Core CPI is more what the government watches when it decides whether to raise interest rates or not. And core CPI, 40% shelter, and shelter is rising, and it's going to continue to rise for some time now, because house prices are not in house prices are not one of the components. But mortgage interest rates are. So mortgage interest rates rising, taxes rising, rents are soaring, apparently, in cities like Vancouver and Toronto and New York and other places. That just guarantees we're going to have inflation going up, or if it doesn't go up, if food and energy comes down rapidly, then the core CPI will still keep going up. But at 5 or 6% core CPI, they're going to have to keep raising rates, and they don't really have any choice, and so it's going to be a very difficult time.
Both Canada and the U.S. have labor shortages. Canada, over 1 million jobs are wanting. In the U.S., it's about 11 million. If there is a recession, the people who thought you could just go out and find a job any day, are they going to be pretty upset that maybe they quit a job where they weren't absolutely happy today?
You know, the whole thing's a mystery. You know, the participation rate in Canada is similar in the U.S., but the numbers in Canada, I think, are fresher in my mind. We're something like 67%, you know, in 2005 or 2004 or something like that. And then after the global financial crisis and after COVID, they went down to 61 or 2%. And this is of the prime working age population. And they haven't really come back up. They've come back up from 61 to 62 or 62 to 63. I forget exactly. But there's a very big gap between where we used to be and where we are today. And that doesn't include the older people. The older people, people over 65, there's actually more of them working now than there normally was over the decades before things started to change so rapidly. So there's something very odd going on in the working population. And, one of the things I think is that, I haven't seen any empirical evidence of this, but it strikes me that because of the handouts that happened in COVID, people got the idea that they could just go and ski full time or something like that. They don't have to work, right? And if they need to work, they'll go back to work, and there'll always be a job there for them. And that's going to be the shock, as your question referred to. Everybody's gotten very comfortable that they could just go and grab a job whenever they need it, when they run out of money, when they take the whole winter off to go skiing. And what if they come back and they find out the job isn't there? So it's, you know, there's so many things right now that I've gotten out of whack. The biggest thing, of course, being not in the labor market, but in the lending and borrowing market, where people got rewarded for borrowing an obscene amount of money and buying speculative assets, and they got rewarded for doing it, and they never suffered. So the rest of us who didn't do that out of prudence or maybe we weren't brave enough are looking at this and saying, all these people are getting rich, and they're taking all this free money that's being put out, and why didn't I do that? So it's one of the excesses that needs to get wrung out of the system. And the only way it happens is a severe recession. You could say, well, the regulators should fix that, but it just never seems to get fixed by the regulators. You have to have a situation where people develop a fear of debt again, and that's going to be only can happen when people suffer from having too much money borrowed. And the same maybe with the working population. Maybe that's what, you know, it sounds harsh, but maybe that's what needs to happen. There needs to be an adjustment in that area too.
We'll have more with Hilliard Macbeth right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Hilliard Macbeth. Hilliard, the Chancellor of Germany, was in Canada a short while ago. We signed a non-binding agreement to supply them with green hydrogen in 3 or 4 years. In the meantime, Germany, other European countries face getting their natural gas supplies cut off by the Russians. Should Canada have made more of an effort to get LNG to Europe?
You know, I don't think so. And I'm amazed at the outcry saying that the government missed the boat and Trudeau's fault. We didn't build more liquefied natural gas. that's been around for at least a decade, probably two decades. And every time somebody looked at it, they said, you know what, it's just too risky. And the reason it's too risky is because you have to build all that infrastructure. And gas is relatively plentiful. The big change that would have killed a Canadian liquefied natural gas industry if we developed one was when they discovered shale oil in Texas and shale gas in Pennsylvania. And there became quite a surplus of natural gas because of that. The shale oil produces, along with the oil, you get natural gas. And they had been flaring it off. They didn't know what to do with it. So now there's about six or seven or eight or nine or ten, I'm not sure exactly how many, liquefaction plants in Louisiana and Texas that is taking that gas from the western part of Texas and exporting it. And you know, it's changed so fast. Like 5 years ago, there were a couple importing because they were importing natural gas, and then now all of a sudden they've got a booming export industry. And the thing is, they're not that far from the coast, from ocean water. So the problem with Alberta natural gas, or even northeastern BC natural gas, is it has to go through a pipeline to get to the coast. Then it has to be liquefied. Then it has to be put in ships. We are not going to be competitive. The other countries that have developed liquefied natural gas industry are Australia. They didn't have one, and they've got many, I don't know, 5 to 10 plants that they've built in the last few years. And of course, in the Middle East and Qatar and other countries like that, they've always had liquefied natural gas that they're willing to export. So, I'm sure Europe would have loved it if all these countries had built a liquefied natural gas plant and they give them a guaranteed contract for a few years. And then, when it comes up for renewal, they can negotiate a much lower price. Because once you've built it, of course, then you have to just, you know, even if it's losing money, you probably still keep shipping the gas because what are you going to do? You spent all those billions of dollars building the industry. So I think actually in the long run, it'll turn out that Canada dodged a bullet not developing a liquefied natural gas industry. Because, of course, the other thing that's changed in the last couple of years is the recognition that natural gas has greenhouse gas emissions that are as harmful in different ways than the greenhouse gas emissions from burning oil and coal. So the longer term, they're going to try and phase out natural gas as well. So it would have been a short-lived industry if we had built it. I don't think it ever would have made any money.
Have the stock markets corrected enough so far to prevent a major crash, or are worse times still ahead?
You know, Jeremy Grantham, I met him in about 2003 or 2004 at a conference in New York. He was a speaker. I think I mentioned this before, but it's good. He stood up, he was speaking to this conference of 250 people, and he stood up there and he started his talk, I've never been wrong. I've been early. So then everybody burst out laughing because I didn't know it, but apparently he had a history of calling the turns in the market, but a little bit too early. So he was famous for having correctly called the dot-com bubble bursting in 1999, 2000, but he was about 2 years too early, which was very expensive. Anyway, so today, fast forward today, and then he got the 2009 one correct as well, and again, he was a couple years too early. And fast forward to 2022. Well, starting in about 2019 or 2020, he started talking about a coming crash in the stock market, and he called it a super bubble. And just this week, he brought out a new paper saying that that of course, now he's looking like he might be right because the stock market has sold off about, at the worst, it was in June, it was down about 22%. And then there's been a rally since then. And it's been up until the last week or so, the rally had been pretty strong. And the rally had recovered about half of the losses in the first downturn. But he says that's normal. In 1929 and other major turning points in the stock market, the exact same thing happened. The stock market would sell off 20, 30% and then would recover a bunch, and then you'd start with a second leg down. And it's pretty convincing, and people could look it up. It's Jeremy Grantham. They can find it, I'm sure. And it's time for the next phase of the crashing of the super bubble, in his opinion. And one of the reasons that it's not over is that earnings. So the stock market course, you've got the prices of the stocks, and then you've got the earnings that the stocks generate, and that's the ratio, price-earnings ratio. And the price-earnings ratios are very high, but it's actually going to get worse because earnings have been inflated by low interest rates, low inflation, and low taxes. And all of those three things are reversing. The taxes are going up on companies. Inflation is much higher now, which initially might give a company a boost in their earnings, but in the longer run, it hurts them quite a bit because they have to pay higher wages and salaries. And taxes, and interest rates, of course, is the big one. Most of the companies, like Canadian Housing, most of the management of companies in North America have gone out and borrowed too much money to buy back their own stock in many cases, to pay dividends bigger than they should have. Now they've got to load it up with a pile of debt. And of course, that debt comes up for renewal, and they have to renew at much higher interest rates. So all of those factors will lower earnings, which means the price-earnings ratio will be even higher than it has, and it's been at record levels recently, records similar to 1929 or 2000. And so the stock prices will have to come down even more. So Jeremy Gratz is saying 50%. So far, we've only gotten down about 20%, so we get about another 30% to go, if he's correct.
Hilliard, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. His website, MacbethMacLeodPartners.com. You can find him on Twitter at HMACBE. If you have any questions for Hilliard or any of our other guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com Radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.